We're going to get started. We're going to call to order the Judiciary Finance and Policy Committee. Today is March 4th, 2014. So we need to have a motion on the minutes, but there was a mistake on the minutes from March 20th of 2013, and the vote on House File 865 was wrong, and what happened is that it needs to be corrected to show that Representative Scott actually voted to oppose the bill. So I'm hoping that we can make a motion to reconsider the minutes of March 20th of 2013, make that amendment to them, and then repass them. It really was just a technical error. There's a motion to reconsider the minutes from March 20th of 2013. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Oppose? Motion prevails. Then the chair would make the motion to correct the minutes to reflect that Representative Scott opposed the bill of House File 865. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Opposed? Motion prevails. Then I need approval for the minutes of April 18th. There a motion? Representative Portman moves the minutes from April 18th of 2013. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevailed. And finally, let's see, we have minutes from May 10th of 2013 that was not approved yet. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. All right. So first we have a bill. Is Representative Rosenthal here? Okay. Do you know if he wants to go right away or does he want us to wait for him? Okay. So why don't we start with, we'll start with House File 2668. It's the court's policy bill. Has anyone else requested this bill? Any other committee requested this bill?
No.
Okay.
I'm sorry, it's civil law. Yes, it's going to civil law.
Okay.
Representative Lesh said it did not.
Representative Lesh said it did not need to go to civil law?
Oh, okay.
Okay. Is that what we heard? We'll find out for sure.
Okay.
So, yes. So then I would move that House File 2668 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Civil Law Committee. And Madam Chair, I do have an author's amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
And Representative Hillstrom, is that the A140804 amendment?
That's correct. Yeah. So I would move the A140804 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it, and then we'll talk about it.
All those in favor of the amendment, signify. Do you want to explain the amendment, Representative Hillstrom?
I think we'll just explain the whole bill once it's amended.
Okay. Representative Hillstrom moves the amendment. All those in favor of the amendment to get the bill in the shape the author would like, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? Motion prevails. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, this was brought to me by the court. It's their policy bill, and so I'd really like to just turn it over to them to talk about what's in the bill and what they are interested in doing. So with me is Judge Peter Cahill.
Judge King?
Cahill.
Judge Cahill?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you also, Representative Hillstrom and Representative Draskowski, for authoring this bill. I am Pete Cahill. I'm the Chief Judge of the 4th Judicial District, which is Hennepin County. And probably more relevant to most of the policy bill, I'm also chair of our e-court steering committee, where we're trying to move forward to an entirely electronic court record. Many of the provisions of this bill pertain specifically to that. And so if I could, I'd just like to walk through some of the different areas that we have. In the first category, we have a number of different initiatives to improve the process for litigants. The first is to require additional information to be submitted to a judge in a structured settlement case. What that involves is very often an injured party will settle a case and receive a structured settlement where they don't receive all the money at once, but it's paid out over a number of years. They have the right to, if they wish, to sell all or part of their settlement to often a company that specializes in such transactions, so they can get a lump sum for all or part of their settlement. It is important for judges to be able to evaluate these to determine if it is an appropriate sale, and the judge has to approve it. Sometimes these people can be vulnerable and desperate for a lump sum, which may not fairly characterize what they should be receiving over the long term, or what their medical needs might characterize over the long term. And so what we are asking is for an additional information be supplied by the, generally it's the company, which is the transferee. They are being transferred the structured settlement, to provide indicating if they have made any other petitions for sale of part or all of the structured settlement, where the petition was filed, and what the result was, and if it was granted, how much of it was sold off. In this way, judges do not have any problem getting the big picture and understanding what has gone on with this settlement from the time it was first entered into until the time that the person stands in front of them wanting a lump sum to settle out their structured settlement. The second one is to provide a request for a hearing in response, it's actually a harassment restraining order, not temporary restraining order. In harassment restraining orders, that it be served within 20 days after the request for hearing, rather, must be made within 20 days after the petition is served. Currently, it's 45 days after the petition is filed. And that may sound like we're speeding things up, but actually it's more fair because sometimes the person might not be served within 45 days after filing. They may not be served until the 44th day. And then according to the statute, the person only has 1 day to actually ask for the hearing. This will make it more fair because it allows the person to have 20 days from whenever they are served. So if they are served 44 days after filing, they have another 20 days to actually demand a hearing to contest the harassment restraining orders. The initial ones being issued by the court without ex parte, that is without the other party present. The third is to essentially codify what is practice. Most courts, when there's a criminal case where both a fine and restitution are ordered, will order that restitution be paid first. That is, make the victim whole before the fine gets paid to the court. If the court is silent on that, the statute, according to the Court of Appeals decided in State versus Knutson, the fine would be paid first. We would like the statute to be clear that when the judge is silent, it should follow normal practice, which is any monies paid in by the defendant should go to the restitution, that is to the victim first, and then to the fine. Under the title of Further eCourt Minnesota Initiatives, again, the eCourt Minnesota is our attempt to become an electronic paperless court, or actually paper on demand. You can always hit the print button. But in order to do that, there are certain things that are unique to paper that we would like to be able to change so that we can, in fact, have electronic documents. The first is to eliminate the requirement that the court seal be a raised seal, that is the embossed seal. Kind of hard to emboss your computer screen, and so we're looking at an electronic seal that contains the name of the court and the seal of the state, which would be standardized by the state court administrator. The second is to remove the requirement for a notary on pleadings and affidavits filed with the court. This does not remove the requirement of a notary in all other documents, real estate, anything else. It's strictly documents that are filed with the court. It would be replaced with a signature line or a statement above the signature line that essentially says that under penalty of perjury, I verify or declare that everything I've said in this document is true. So it would subject the person to the penalties of perjury because one of the other sections modifies the perjury statute to make that clear, that signing such a document is the same as verification upon oath or affirmation. We, of course, probably share the concern that I could slightly detect among committee members about the possibility of fraud, people signing other people's name. And we have Susan Ledre, who is leaving the district court, but while she was one of our senior managers in charge of our Pro Se Self-Help Center, checked with a variety of different states, California, Texas, Kansas, a variety of others, and found that they have instituted the same type of provision and have found virtually no fraud. Part of that is because this is not an area where people are engaging in fraud. I'm going to file a lawsuit in your name. There's really no benefit to paying $300 to file a lawsuit in somebody else's name, so when it comes to court, nobody shows up. It's not an area that lends itself to people wanting to steal identities or commit forgery, but it does provide that if you were to do that, it would be subject to penalties of perjury. The third provision is to permit e-service for certain probate cases. Unlike civil, which is governed largely by civil rules on service, the probate statute actually has statutes governing how things should be served. And what we are requesting is to change the statute to allow for electronic service. Our entire electronic court record is based on electronic filing and electronic service. And the electronic service has been a great benefit to the bar because simply through that process, they don't have to hire couriers, they don't have to print out the paper and have somebody serve if they can catch them. It's all based on electronic transmission. And because the probate statute has a few statutes that still require mail, U.S. mail, we would like the option of having e-service as an option and if required by Supreme Court order. And the last one is to create an efficiency in that the errors and omission petitions in election matters. Right now, there is no requirement that the other candidates or any candidates in the contest be served. So if there's an error in the ballot, somebody can file a petition and essentially suing the auditor or the person who's in charge of printing the ballot. There's no requirement that they serve the candidates who obviously have an interest in it. Realistically, because the statute says that anyone else who the court determines should be served, the Supreme Court always immediately says, serve all the candidates. As opposed to building in that delay, we're asking that it be changed so that the statute actually requires that all candidates that are affected by that ballot petition be served right from the get-go. That saves us some delay where it gets filed with the Supreme Court, they look at it, they issue an order saying, serve all the candidates, because it's what they do in every case. And so with that, I'd stand for questions.
Are there questions for Judge Cahill from members? Any questions?
I believe there may be some other folks that may want to testify on that.
Okay. Bill. Thank you, Judge Cahill. Mr. Shorba, were you? No? Okay. Thank you. Please say your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
My name is Kevin Rich. My last name is spelled R-I-A-C-H. I'm an attorney at Frederickson and Byron in Minneapolis, and I appreciate the chance to just say a few words about the changes to the Structured Settlement Act, and thank Madam Chair and Judge Cahill for inviting me to speak today. As you can see, it changes the amount of information that's provided to judges at the time that a judge considers whether or not to approve a structured settlement transfer. The required additional information is critical because right now the way the process works, a person who's interested in transferring their annuity will be contacted by a factoring company, the transferee who's essentially buying the annuity, and those individuals will approach a judge and ask for approval. There's no adversarial process as it traditionally stands with regard to structured settlements. Everybody who comes into court is interested in one thing, which is achieving the transfer that they've already agreed upon. It's not always in the transferee's best interest, and sometimes it's difficult for judges to know exactly what the context is for a transfer request. Specifically, if there's been a previous transfer, that information traditionally has not been required by the statute. I was an attorney on a case in which another attorney at Frederickson named Kimberly Lowe was appointed as a guardian by a district court judge in Hennepin County to help the court evaluate whether or not a transfer was appropriate for a woman who was seeking to sell some of her annuity. She had already transferred to the same factoring company that she was working on the transfer that she was seeking approval for. She had transferred an annuity worth about $270,000 for $46,000 in cash. And she was in the court seeking to transfer another $300,000 in annuity payments for $19,000. And the court became concerned after talking to this woman that there had been additional transfers that had occurred that the court hadn't been informed about. And that's when Ms. Lowe was appointed, and I began to assist Ms. Lowe. And the information we were able to gather for the court was very important for the court to determine whether or not this was a good decision for everybody. And the changes that are being made to the bill are meant to make it easier for judges to get that kind of information, and that's why I'm here to speak in support of it. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Are there questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone else in the audience that wants to be heard on this bill? No?
With that, Madam Chair, I would move that House File 2668 be recommended to pass and be sent to the Civil Law Committee.
Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2668 be re-referred as amended to the Civil Law Committee. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed? So moved. House File 2668 as amended is re-referred to Civil Law.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Representative,
thank
Paul
you. Here. Madam Chair, I do not see Representative Rosenthal. Do you want to go to your next bill?
I will. Thank you. I would move that House File 2479 be recommended to pass and be re-referred and sent to the General Register. And I do have an amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it. It's the A140786 amendment.
Thank you. Representative Hillstrom, would you like to move your amendment?
Yes, I move the A14-0786 amendment to get the bill in the shape that I would like it.
Any discussion? All those in favor of adopting the amendment to get the bill in the form that the author would prefer, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, motion prevails. Representative Hillstrom, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. Members, this too was brought to me by the court. And with me is Judge Cahill to talk about what the bill does and why it's here.
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, thank you again. Pete Cahill, Chief Judge of the 4th District. This is a bill that would remove the right to demand a judge in a housing court case. We generally use referees in housing court because it is a very narrow technical area of the law, and the referees essentially are specialists in that area. We deal with a large volume in Hennepin County, and the referees handle probably 95%. We only have 79 judge demands because the statute does allow you to simply demand a judge hear your case. When that happens, it gets referred to a judge. It's not enough judge demands for us to regularly schedule a judge on that assignment, but it's enough that it's extremely disruptive to the rest of the business of the court because we have to find a judge who's available, assign the case to them. And to be honest, it generally takes a judge about twice the amount of time it does a referee because they have to get used to the law or read up on the law because, it, as I said, it's a very technical area requiring a fair amount of expertise. To be honest, most judges return to the bench book that was written by one of the referees about housing landlord-tenant law. This provides a great efficiency for us if the person cannot demand a judge but essentially could still remove a referee, but they would get another referee. So they do have the right to remove a referee if they are not pleased with that person generally. This also does not remove the right to have a judge review. The decision of a referee can be reviewed in a very informal manner without any additional cost by the person asking that a judge review it. In that case, there is usually a hearing in which the parties can argue that the judge misapplied the law or was clearly erroneous in their factual findings. So it provides a very informal, very cheap method for people who are in housing court to have an appeal without filing an appeal directly to the Court of Appeals. That would remain in place. If some of you have longer memories than I, you can remember that I think we had talked about perhaps stripping that away, but in discussions with both the landlord and tenant bar, that really we didn't think was a good idea. But to have the efficiencies of referees remaining the experts on these cases and avoiding the disruption that judge demands cause, we would ask for your support of this bill.
Are there questions from members? Representative Lesh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Judge Cahill, you had said your current caseload does not justify you placing one judge on a housing court calendar. But what about when the caseload expands, and it would, say, I don't know, 5 years from now or 4 years from now, you have enough housing court cases based on increased population, then we're effectively removing this as a remedy from folks. How close would you say you are to having enough for one judge to handle?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair and Representative Lesh, we actually have enough for more than one judicial officer now. But the reason why we use referees is because, it, as I said, a very technical area of the law, and there's a high volume, and there are very tight time frames. This is not something where it can go on a judge's calendar and they schedule a trial 3 months from now. We're talking turnaround in days, actually. And by having that expertise and the ability to move fast on high volume, referees actually work much better and much more efficient. So our plan would be, even if the volume would increase, we would prefer to use referees because of that, because of that dynamic.
Okay, thank you. Madam Chair.
Representative Lesh.
And Judge Cahill, how many current judges do you have on the bench in Hennepin County? How many slots, or are there vacancies? And then how many referees do you currently have?
Judge Cahill.
Madam Chair, Representative Lesh, we have 62 judges, and for the next hour and a half, we have all the slots filled. Judge Dufresne is finishing her last day, and then we'll have a vacancy starting tomorrow. We have approximately 14 referees, but they are not all full-time. We have some part-time referees. That's also the other advantage of referees, is we can scale how much they work. We have a 0.8 referee. We have a 0.6 referee. So we can hire people to scale to the amount of work we have and not just throw another judge on it.
And Madam Chair.
Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I actually have Paul
Bernberg
from Homeline, who wishes to testify in favor of the proposal as well.
Okay, he can come forward. If there's any other questions for Judge Cahill? No. Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman, Chairwoman, and members. My name is Paul Bernberg. I'm the senior housing attorney at Homeline. Very briefly, Homeline's a tenant advocacy group. Some of what we do is litigation housing court, both in Ramsey and Hennepin County, which would be affected by this bill. I came here because essentially I felt honor-bound to come last biennium. As Judge Cahill indicated, there was an effort to eliminate both judge demand and judge review. The opposition from the citizenry was our organization and Larry McDonough, who's sort of the chief housing guru for tenants. Mr. McDonough is not able to come here today because he's out of town, but so I came on essentially on both our behalves. But we opposed that bill because of concerns that eliminating both judge demand and judge review would be unconstitutional and on policy grounds, mostly covered by Judge Cahill, that judge review has the advantage of providing a safety valve, a mini appeal, resolves most cases, it's cheap for pro se people, probably saves the state a ton of money because it diverts cases that might have to go to the Court of Appeals. This proposal, I think for Homeline, I think I can say that this is okay. This is certainly we're mildly in favor of this. I think Mr. McDonough would speak even more highly of the bill. I'll just comment, I think there's an implied contract here that as this goes forward, there's an implied agreement, and I think Judge Keller would agree with me that the chief judge of Ramsey and Hennepin both appoint housing court referees that are fair-minded and don't have access to grind. The last thing I wanted to ask was about the effective date. I didn't see the amendment. Was the amendment to change the effective date? Okay, I think that's a wise thing to change the effective date so that people get a heads up and you don't end up with somebody literally on the last hour having to change. So that's all I had to say.
Are there questions from members for the testifier? Seeing none. Is there anyone else in the audience who would like to be heard on the bill? Representative Drazkowski.
Madam Chair, just checking the trajectory of this bill. Should it go to the Housing Committee next?
Representative Drazkowski, I'm told the Housing Committee declined to hear it. Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. We checked with Representative Clark's committee and they said they didn't need to see it.
Any other questions from members? Representative Hillstrom renews her motion that House File 2479 be re-referred as amended to the General Register. All those in favor of the motion signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed? So moved. House File 2479 is re-referred to the General Register.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members.
Thank you. Representative Rosenthal. Representative Rosenthal, House File 2190. What's the motion? Civil law. And I will move House File 2190 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. Representative Rosenthal, to your bill.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks for sending me to Civil Law.
You're welcome.
I sit on that committee. Anyway, Madam Chair, members, House File 2190 is an update to Chapter 302A of the Minnesota Statute, otherwise known as the Minnesota Business Corporation Act. The bill was supported by the Minnesota State Bar Association, the Business Law Section of the Minnesota State Bar. The statute was last updated in 2010 and in 2008 before that. Here to testify today on the for the Bar Association is Professor John Matheson, University of Minnesota Law School's Corporate Institute, and I'll turn it over to him for technical questions.
Welcome. Please state your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hi. Thank you, Madam Chair and members. My name is John Matheson, faculty member at the University of Minnesota Law School. I'll give you a little bit of background on this bill. Every few years, notice goes out among bar members that the Bar Association is forming a committee to consider changes to the Minnesota Business Corporation Act. And I've served on that committee for a number of years. A number of people joined that committee. I think I saw on the email list 62 people who wanted to be involved in some way or another. The committee meets. There's representatives of the various law schools, representatives of the Secretary of State's office, representatives of corporate interests, representative of plaintiffs' interests, shareholder interests, all participate in this process, which is really to look at the Minnesota Business Corporation Act, try to bring it up to date, both in comparison to other states' laws and events that have taken place, and simply to make sure that it's technically accurate. Most of the proposals that you have before you are of a technical nature. They're wordsmithing, changes, updating because of changes such as limited liability companies being involved and needed to be included in the statutes. The committee meets. It met for about 6 months every 2 weeks. None of the proposals before you have any opposition from the committee that was formed. Was presented to the Executive Council of the Minnesota State Bar Association Business Law Section and approved unanimously there. I know of no opposition to this bill, but I would like to highlight for you several pieces of the bill that you may have some interest in because they're probably beyond, quote, technical amendments and make changes that you should know about. One is that the bill allows for an expanded use of what are called cross-border conversions. Right now, typically, a company starts by forming as an LLC, a limited liability company. Later in its development, it may become a corporation when it does an initial public offering or otherwise is successful. Right now, our current statute allows changes between those two forms for Minnesota entities, but does not allow for changes between Minnesota entities and entities of other states, particularly that might include Delaware. Minnesota LLC might ultimately end up as a Delaware corporation before it does an initial public offering. The statute simply allows for that expanded version of conversions from one form of entity to another. Most other states, including Delaware, allow for that form of action. We're just keeping up to speed with the what's being demanded in the marketplace for that sort of activity. Another provision of the statute that's very pro business and helpful to business transactions is the fact that we're going to make a formal a process for pre-clearing of documents filed with the Secretary of State. Let me say that in significant corporate transactions, the parties, such as mergers or large financings, the parties want to know before the day of closing that the documents they're going to file, if necessary, with the Secretary of State, will be approved. Very, very honestly, over the years, the Secretary of State's Office of Minnesota has informally done this service for members of the bar and business interests. The amendment that you're being presented today to the statute makes that process formal. That is that a document that otherwise needs to be filed with the Secretary of State can be presented in advance of actual filing. The Secretary of State's office will review it, ask for any changes, but then when the day comes where everything needs to get done that day, the document will be pre-approved. That's an important step forward. Delaware has a provision that allows for pre-clearance of documents filed with the Secretary of State. That's very beneficial to help get business done in Minnesota. The final provision that I'll flag for you, and believe me, I'm happy to go through all 38 sections of the bill for you, but they're mostly technical and very disparate. But the final one that I'd like to flag for you is one that actually came out of a Minnesota Supreme Court decision last term, U.S. Bank versus Cold Spring Granite. I actually testified at the trial court level in that case. You may know that in the operation of corporations, majority generally rules, same with limited liability companies, and that sometimes majority interests squeeze out minority interests. When that takes place in almost all circumstances, minority shareholders do have rights. Primarily, those are dissent and appraisal rights, that is, the opportunity to be bought out at fair value, even if they're going to be eliminated, and have a judicial determination of fair value. In our current statute, there's a method for squeezing out shareholders by way of a reverse stock split that does not allow for appraisal. So a shareholder could be squeezed out as a minority shareholder in a current Minnesota corporation, and the value determination of that shareholder's shares would be solely by the board of directors, which may be controlled by the majority shareholder, honestly, and there's no judicial review of that value determination. The proposal here is to amend the statute to provide for dissent and appraisal rights in that circumstance as well, so that minority shareholders would be protected and have a fair value determination of their interest if that happens. I'm happy to take other questions or questions from the committee. Those are the primarily, quote, close to substantive proposals on the of the bill.
Thank you. Are there questions from members? Representative Hortman.
I just want to say it's nice to see my corporation's professor, Melissa Hortman, class of 95. And it's just fun to hear you explain corporations yet again. So nice to see you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions from members? Representative Hillstrom.
Thank you. So I'm looking on page 7 of the bill, line 7.13 and 7.14. It's talking about folks not being liable. Is that a new change in liability, or is that just a reformation of the same standard of liability?
Professor Matheson.
Oh, yes. Thank you. Literally, all that's being done in that section is when action is taken pursuant to written consent by shareholders as opposed to voting at a meeting, the statute currently provides that all shareholders must be given notice of that written consent. All that the amendment does here is say that if you actually sign the consent, you don't have to get notice. Nothing on liability is changed by this amendment.
Any other questions from members? Is there anyone else in the audience that wants to be heard either for or against this bill? Are there questions from members for the author? Seeing none, I will renew my motion that House File 2190 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. All those opposed, motion prevails.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Representative Portman moves that House File 2188 be recommended to pass and be sent to civil law. Civil law.
Okay. Chairman Lesh, we'll see it next.
Representative Portman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This is the Minnesota State Bar Association Real Property Bill, and I have with me Kevin Dunleavy, a member of the Minnesota State Bar Association, to explain the bill.
Welcome to the committee. State your name for the record and go ahead.
Madam Chair, my name is Kevin Dunleavy, and I co-chair the Legislative Committee of the Real Property Section of the State Bar Association. This is a technical bill dealing with real estate. The first part of the bill is intended to take out gender-specific language regarding designated transfers. Those are transfers between entities that are solely owned by either an individual or by a married couple, and there's no deed tax on that. And the statute previously referred to husband and wife, so we're just talking about spouses now. And second section is the acknowledgement statute. Acknowledgement statute of record now says the acknowledgement on a deed or a mortgage has to be by husband and wife. And this says that there just has to be some indication that they're a married couple. And husband and wife would still serve to do that. I don't think it changes that custom and practice. 50702, that's the statute that says both spouses have to sign a deed or a mortgage on a homestead or it's void. And that also is amended to take out the gender-specific language and just say spouses. Then Section 4 deals with transfer and death deeds. Transfer and death deeds are used to essentially for a property owner to not have to go to probate. If they own a piece of property, they can use a transfer and death deed. It usually works best when there's one child so that there's not a fight among the children, but it's a way to avoid transfer. That Minnesota, I think, took the lead on transfer and death deeds a few years ago, and it's, I think, an example to the rest of the country for transfer and death deeds. Anyway, what we've done is we've clarified the difference between a grantor owner and a grantor, and an owner. See, it's confusing for me even. A grantor owner, let's say there's three brothers that own a piece of property, and one of them wants to convey by a transfer on death deed to his heirs, his children. The other two don't want to do that. So he's the grantor owner. He grants his interest in the property by a transfer on death deed that becomes effective when he dies. And then the other two brothers are owners. They're not grantors. So only the grantor owner's interest in the property would pass. The definition of what's an interest in real property is expanded to clarify that a security interest, a contract for deed, all kinds of things that deal with real property can also be passed by a transfer on death deed. The amendment also clarifies situations when if you have multiple grantors, can one of them cancel the transfer on death deed, or do all of them have to do it? And this amendment says if one of them cancels, it's gone. It's gone for all of them. And these are all things that we think were the law, but there was confusion, particularly among attorneys that are drafting these deeds, and so they're intended to give guidance to the attorneys that are drafting the transfer on death deeds. If it's a joint tenants, if property is owned by joint tenants, the spouses have to sign. That's intuitive, but we're saying it now. And if a non-titled spouse, okay, so one spouse owns the property, the other spouse only has what's called a marital interest, and if the one that has the title transfers it, the spouse that doesn't have title has to consent, or else the property is still subject to the marital interest. And the marital interest vests when a couple is divorced or if the person who was in title dies, so there's a probate estate. There's no intent to change the law regarding how this works either. It doesn't. There's no intent to change priority of liens or mortgages or medical assistance liens or anything else like that that might affect the marital interest in real property with the transfer and death deed. Okay, that's probably the most complicated part of this. Partial release of mortgage is Section 10. Last year, the real property section asked the legislature to amend the statute that allows for satisfaction of mortgages to also provide for releases of mortgages. And this was intended to be used in like residential developments where there's 50 lots in the development and the mortgages on the whole thing. And when each lot is sold, there's a partial release of the mortgage. There wasn't any statutory authority for that. And when we did it, we also tweaked the part of the statute that deals with forged satisfactions. And the statute says that someone who signs a forged satisfaction or who records a forged satisfaction or release is liable. Well, the title companies objected to the recording part because they could be recording a satisfaction without knowing that it's forged. And we agreed with them, and really the person that should be liable is the person that signed it. If they're the ones that know that the document is forged. And if they record it, they should be liable. They don't need to be liable additionally as a recorder. So the tweak is to just take out the reference to whoever records the satisfaction. Last one is Section 11 is redemption periods. There used to be one redemption period in Minnesota. It was 1 year. So if you foreclosed a mortgage, if a creditor foreclosed a mortgage, the debtor had 1 year to pay it off and then keep the property. Well, now we've got a 5-week redemption period, a 60-day redemption period, a 120-day redemption period, and a 6-month redemption period. So the statute has just changed to say, instead of referring to a 1 year, it's just applicable redemption period. Thank you.
Questions from members? Seeing none, is there anyone in the audience who wishes to testify for or against this bill? Seeing none, Representative Portman renews her motion that House File 2188 be re-referred to the Committee on Civil Law. All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails.
Thank you.
Members, that concludes the business of the committee. We're adjourned.